Welcome. I'm Jenny Ray, an independent consultant with the Military Families Learning Network Family Transitions team. Our team provides education, resources, and networking opportunities for military family service professionals as they help military families build resilience and navigate life cycle transitions. We invite you to engage with us and your colleagues in conversations on life cycle issues. In this Let's Talk Transitions podcast, I chat with Dr. Kate Hendricks-Thomas, U.S. Marine Veteran Officer and Behavioral Health Researcher. Kate shares her personal experience of the challenges she had when transitioning from the active duty component to civilian life. These hurdles motivated Kate to research and then educate others about the importance of mental fitness and performance, all to ensure that other service members who follow after her do not have to fight the same battles as Kate once did. Several culturally specific resources are shared to better assist professionals as you work specifically with female service members, women veterans, and their families. Without any further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Kate Hendricks-Thomas. Welcome, Dr. Hendricks-Thomas. It is an honor and it's a privilege to have you here with me today talking with me. Can we begin by sharing with the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure. So I am a military mental health researcher and a college professor, but I wasn't always interested in public health, although that's what I spend all of my time on now. I grew up in a military family, and through childhood social conditioning, I decided to join the Marine Corps myself to follow in the footsteps of my father. And I spent a couple of years on active duty, and then I spent a few more years in the reserves. And the Marine Corps was a wonderful experience for me. It pushed my envelope. It gave me opportunities to lead that I wouldn't have had anywhere else. You know, I certainly got to travel and see much of the country and some of the world. It was a fantastic experience. But when I left the Marine Corps, my intention was to go to graduate school, become a normal girl again, go have a little bit more freedom. And I thought that transitioning from the active duty component was going to be a simple thing. And for me, it was not. I had a really difficult time. You don't just lose your job. You lose your sense of professional fulfillment. There's this strong sense of purpose when you're in the military. I lost that when I left. I also had trouble with the loss of identity. So I had been a Marine officer, and that was a big part of my identity. And when I got out of the military, I no longer was. So who was I? I also was a little bit hard on myself, the way a lot of people in the military are. You know, we want to meet a certain standard, because if you don't meet that standard, people can get hurt. So I was very intense, and I knew how to press the gas, but not really the brake. Mm-hmm. So my own transition was marked by a lot of things that I study now, maladaptive coping mechanisms, and I was basically a disaster. And I started studying why. Why was I such a disaster? Was this just my own experience wandering through that liminal space that is transition? Or is this kind of, are these systemic issues? Are these things we can do something about? And that's my work today, finding ways to get in between the veteran and the risk factors that come with transitioning from the active duty component.
That's really cool. I love the backstory and how things just kind of dominoed. This just kind of led to that. And they just kind of each had a little puzzle piece to your story. So thank you for sharing that.
I love that T.S. Eliot quote that not all who wander are lost. I wandered quite a bit when I left the Marine Corps.
You know, my husband is active duty right now, but he was enlisted and got out, and there was a side of him that I was like, who is this person? And I think he also felt lost. And so now I'm understanding that perspective from kind of like a different point of view, but I'm definitely recognizing that a lot more.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So he got back in after his initial
He
end
did.
Of active service?
Yes. So he finished up college and then applied for the officer candidate program and got in. And so now we are in Beaufort, South Carolina. He's trying to be a jet pilot. So
that is so exciting.
Yeah, it's really, really cool. And every day he tells me how humbled he is because, you know, I don't think when he got out of the military, I don't think he saw that for his life. And I think that's where I see you. There's a lot of things that you have flourished from your past and that you're making so much leadway and development, and all these great things are coming out of the things that you just, you know, studied yourself as your own lab rat. You were the own.
Yes. There's nothing like being your own lab rat. That's the perfect way to put it.
Yeah. Just kind of testing it to see what is going on. Like, how can I fix this myself? That's really cool.
Yeah. Well, my family, you know, for a long time, I mean, my family, my close friends, everybody in my circle for a very long time was military. So it's the reason that I would get into this work after I left the service. There's something about wanting to help the people that come after you, after you've stood your watch, and wanting it to be a little bit easier, a little bit smoother for the next generation that stands on the yellow footprints.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I feel like a lot of people do value that, but maybe they don't take steps forward to make that happen. So it's great that you are. So one of the things that I've looked up about you is that you spent the specific topics that you've studied or are working on and researching is evidence-based mental fitness and performance. And to our listeners, maybe they might understand what these terms mean, but to me, I kind of need a little bit more further explanation. So I wonder if you would be willing to share a little bit about what that means, what it is in practice, and that kind of stuff.
Sure. Well, so I'll try to make a long story short, but when I was in Iraq, my little brother also flew in for his deployment, and I was able to see him as he came in to Takadam and was going to head up to Ramadi. During his deployment, right at the tail end of mine, his vehicle ran over a double-stacked IED, and he was wounded pretty severely, and a couple of Marines didn't leave that incident. So I was at the hospital with him as he was recovering, and I was trying to support him as he was recovering. And I got really interested in adaptive wellness and fitness because, you know, what you're working with are some Marines like my brother who had been an athlete his whole life, and now he was physically changed. How is he still going to remain an athlete? Mm-hmm. So a lot of the work I started doing was just on adaptive yoga, adaptive CrossFit. How can you maybe have an amputation and still do CrossFit? It's absolutely possible with the right adaptations. Mm-hmm. So the more I worked on fitness and wellness, the more I realized that a big problem for transitioning service members, whether they were wounded or not wounded, was social health, emotional health, you know, things a little bit deeper than just physical well-being. And so I started studying the impact of emotional health, spiritual health, really a holistic approach to somebody promoting their wellness. And that's what I talk about when I say that I work in peak performance and I study mental fitness. There is a science behind mental fitness. So just as you do bicep curls to grow your biceps and improve your physical fitness, you can do some very specific things that work your brain and that cause your brain to grow and expand and actually function better for you. And that's what I call bulletproofing the brain or bulletproofing the psyche. And it's a series of mindfulness practices conducted in a regular schedule. It can actually change your prefrontal cortex. It actually grows your gray matter and improves your cognitive functioning. So mental fitness, it matters not just for somebody that's recovering from transition or a wound or somebody who's going through a hard time. It's not just for people that need treatment. that sort of practice, that bulletproofing your brain, is useful for people that feel absolutely fantastic to enhance their performance. You'll become a better parent, a better friend, a better professional by doing these very specific mental fitness training techniques. You're actually better and smarter, and you lose your car keys less often. So there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good for embracing these practices. And that's what I try to promote today with my writing, my research, and my speaking. I try to sell this notion of bulletproofing your brain, not just to treat stuff that's happened in the past, but to get yourself ready for what may come at you in the future.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And I love the terminology because it's very military-esque as well.
And that's, I think it's important. You know, there's a lot of, you know this, there's a lot of stigma against care seeking. Nobody wants to go see a counselor or they don't want to be seen as in need of some sort of intervention. And what's great about training and mental fitness training is that it treats stress, injury, and depression, but we're not talking about it as treatment. We're talking about it as something that any really ambitious person who wants to enhance their own performance does. Mm-hmm. And so that helps make it more accessible for people who really wouldn't go see a traditional counselor.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you touched base on the stigma piece because that seems to be very relevant, especially for female veterans as they're transitioning out. Do you find that it's, for those that you work with, it's more gender-based so that there's more men or women that feel the stigma, or is this both?
That's a great question. That's a really good question. So a lot of my research is on mental health outcomes in women veterans. And women veterans are about twice as likely as male veterans to suffer depression or stress injury, both diagnosed and undiagnosed conditions. And a lot of the reason for that are issues of unit cohesion while on active duty. Mm-hmm. So social support is really important for your mental health and your well-being. And if you're constantly a numerical minority operating against stereotype threat, trying to prove yourself all the time, that can be very exhausting mentally. And so that can create a little bit more risk for stress, injury, or depression in women veterans. It can be a little bit harder for women veterans to find a community of support when they leave the military, because there just aren't very many of them. There aren't very many of us. And it can be difficult to go back into a civilian community coming from the active duty component, where a lot of your behaviors might have, in order to be effective, maybe some of your behaviors would become masculinized. So I know when I left the military, I got criticized for having too firm of a handshake. So I shook hands too hard. But in the Marine Corps, if you don't do that, you're going to not be taken seriously.
Right.
I was told that I was striding too aggressively when I walked. My walk wasn't feminine enough. And it was, you know, funny, and I laugh about it now, but those are very real things that matter when you walk into a civilian corporation hiring fair, for example. So these are definitely issues that women veterans deal with.
Yeah, I'm sorry for laughing, but I it's kind of one of those things that you're like, yeah, I could see that. So that would be definitely a big adjustment, I would think.
Yes, absolutely.
So our listeners are those that work with military families, and, you know, those that are in transitioning from the military life to civilian life, for service members to veterans. So you talked about stigma, and you talked about these issues or these challenges that women in the military and female veterans face. And I wonder what you might suggest are some good resources or places to start to kind of help move those, you know, take those steps forward in helping those individuals.
Absolutely. Well, I think the first thing that any helping professional can do is be really, really up to date on all of the current research. So there's a book that I worked on with a colleague of mine called Invisible Veterans. And we share in that book, we share some of the issues that military women face while they're transitioning from active duty. We share some stories. Sometimes I think it's really wonderful to learn from somebody's narrative experience. You know, to an anecdote can kind of be as informative as a data point. And I would recommend doing a little bit of research and reading and, you know, learning about the stigma issues that women veterans face, as well as their feelings that places that are useful for veterans are not necessarily for them. And I'll give you an example. So I did a needs assessment with a large group of women veterans, and I asked them about their participation in veteran service organizations. So these are the organizations that are supposed to help veterans with their transition. They're supposed to help them translate the social capital of service into, you know, a successful life on the outside. And 75% of my respondents were not a member of a veteran service organization.
Wow.
So the majority of respondents in this study were not taking advantage of these resources because they felt like it was an uncomfortable place to be as a woman, like it wasn't built for them, or they just felt like what the organization did didn't really meet their needs. And that's a huge area of opportunity, I think, educating organizations on how to reach out to women veterans, not just how to get them to join, but how to get them to stay. Mm-hmm. Something as simple as providing childcare at an event can be, you know, all just really important to a woman veteran who's more likely statistically to be a caregiver of dependent children. So there's a lot that we can do to be inclusive and to intentionally reach out to military women leaving the service.
Mm-hmm. Wow, those are great examples. I'm still surprised that it's 75% that did not participate. That number makes my stomach kind of turn. I'm like, oh man, that's a bummer. But those are great suggestions that our professionals, I think, could benefit from. So thank you for sharing those.
Well, and thank you for the work that you guys do for military families. It's vital.
Yeah, we're just trying to make our headway. We're just trying to make, just one step at a time. And I think that we all just are part of that puzzle. We just contribute our little bits and do what we can. Okay, so I guess maybe we could talk a little bit about that article, the depression prevalence and geographic distribution in the United States military women. These were results from a 2017 Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN, needs assessment. So I guess could you talk a little bit about the article, what the survey was about, and some of the main findings, just kind of in a brief summary?
Absolutely.
Okay.
So what we were doing with this assessment was trying to check for mental health outcomes. We asked people if they had existing cases of depression. Had they ever been told that they were struggling with stress injury or depression? And then we asked them a couple of questions that indicate symptoms of a previously undiagnosed condition. So we were looking to see how much depression was prevalent among women veterans across the country. And what we found was that women were twice as likely as their male partner, as their male colleagues, to have stress injury or depression. And we also found that it was more likely to be a problem for women veterans who lived in the Southeast. And what is useful about that information is it really gives us targeting opportunities. So if we know that there's a programming and an outreach need in the Southeastern United States, our network of government and veteran organizations can come together to try to meet that need in targeted fashion. Mm-hmm. And that's really what we were trying to do with that article. We were trying to raise awareness of how difficult transition was and is for military women, and just kind of highlight the fact that there's tremendous need for resources. A lot of programs were not built with military women in mind.
Mm. That's a valid point. And very powerful. I guess one of the questions that popped up when you were talking about that is, in the Southeast, then have there been any shifts forward? I know the article was published in 2018. I just wondered if there's any steps forward that have been made that you are aware of that kind of helped.
Really, there really have been. And some Southeastern states have done an incredible job putting together veteran outreach task forces. Mm. I think particularly the state of Alabama has a state task force that's working on outreach to veterans. And there have been some really large assessments and research efforts done in the Southeastern United States. In the city of Atlanta, there are some incredible outreach programs. America's Warrior Partnership and then Vetlanta. There are just a lot of people trying to make a dent in those numbers.
That's fantastic news. I guess how would professionals be able to connect with these resources?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you know, anytime you go into a new area, it's important to figure out who are the actors, who are the organizations and the leaders that are making a difference in that area. So really just talking to key organizational stakeholders, like if you're interested in outreach to women veterans, you know, approaching the women's health coordinator at the local VA mm-hmm. might be a really great way to get connected to transition efforts in the community. Every VA also has a transition clinic. And those clinics mm-hmm. can be helpful in terms of finding out what organizational partnerships are thriving in that local area. There's also, you know, really just working with collaboratives. America's Warrior Partnership, for example, is a collaborative based out of Atlanta, Georgia. And what they do is pull resources together and you know, do referrals and try to connect the spider web of efforts that are out there. So you can really, by talking to a collaborative or talking to someone at your local VA, you can find out who the boots on the ground are, who the people are that you will be working with.
Okay, great. Thank you for sharing that. Because I think what we do sometimes when I write blogs or I share the resources, they're all there. And I think sometimes the list can be so daunting, it's hard to know where to start. And so I think this will be, you know, kind of provide some areas or some avenues that are thinking outside of the box and being able to work with, as you said, people who are boots on the ground and kind of connecting those dots.
And, you know, depending on where you are, some cities, the city council or the chamber of commerce has veteran initiatives going on. And you can always ask those questions as well.
Okay. Because I think that much of our listeners are advocates as well, because they are working with the service members, they're working with the veterans and the families. And so they see all these issues firsthand. And then I think they can, back in return, share these, you know, these issues or raise awareness to these collaboratives or the city council. And so I'm glad that you shared those options with me. I guess what I wanted to reference to was that when you talked about the Swan Survey article, I wondered about what these findings might mean for the professionals that work with military families, service members, and veterans.
Well, a lot of the work that I've done on women veterans highlights the gap between what programming should be in terms of accessibility and tailoring to the needs of women veterans and where we actually are. So I think what's important is to look and see what's happening in your given area and to check for cultural competency. So I'll give you an example. I lived in a southeastern United States city for a while that was trying really hard to reach women veterans. And one of the ways that they did that was by planning a spa night. And they advertised the spa night for women veterans and spouses of service members. And so it wasn't just an event for women veterans. They had opened it up to spouses of service members as well. And they couldn't figure out why, when they got everyone together for spa night, they couldn't figure out why more cohesion and more social networking wasn't happening. Well, you know, these groups are different groups. They have different things that are important in their lives. And so, you know, doing an event that wasn't tailored specifically to women veterans wound up, you know, meaning the event wasn't as effective as it could have been. So one of the most important things is figuring out need, what's being done well, and then checking to see if what's being done is actually inclusive. So there's some really great veteran service organizations that get a lot of women participating. And I'm thinking specifically of Team Red, White, and Blue and The Mission Continues. A significant portion of their membership is female. And there's something about those organizations' accessibility and what they do that makes women veterans feel like that's a place for them to participate and volunteer. So looking at what those organizations are doing as a best practice is probably a good idea as well.
That's great. I didn't realize that a lot of women are kind of find those places as home. That's really cool. I guess for the professional, then they could kind of reach out to these resources. And as you said, kind of seeing what they're doing for best practices and maybe not necessarily try to replicate it, but use it in their own work to see how they might be able to reach more is kind of what I'm thinking along those lines.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. You know, and looking to work in partnership with these organizations can be really great. They're very collaborative organizations, and they, you know, like to work with people like your providers.
Okay. That's great to know. So I kind of am wondering about the programs that either you are conducting or the ones that you collaborate with. What are some examples of how to, you know, like build this resilience or build this mental fitness with individuals? So you shared some examples, but I wondered just a little bit more. I'm kind of curious about what that kind of looks like.
Sure. So there's a current example that I can give you right now that I'm very excited about. And there is a veteran and a college professor named Dr. Elizabeth Stanley, who teaches at Georgetown University. She has created a course with Sounds True, if you've ever heard of that publishing company. And her course is called, is on mental fitness. It's, I forget the, it's MMFT is the acronym, and it stands for mindfulness and mental fitness training. And she is offering this training to veterans, first responders, and caregivers free. So you can go to Sounds True and look up Liz Stanley's course, and you could take this virtual training to help you understand how to bulletproof your brain, to help you understand how to create mental fitness.
That's great.
That would be one resource I would check out soon, because it's time sensitive and it's free and it's fantastic. I think that's a really good place to go.
I couldn't agree more. That makes me excited.
Yeah. I was looking at it just the other day, and I'm so excited and proud that Dr. Stanley agreed to make it free to mm-hmm. first responders, you know, people working in healthcare, military veterans, people who will really benefit from the training. And it's all virtual, so it's suitable for COVID time.
Great. That's fantastic.
Another resource for places to go. Yes, there's one other that I would suggest. And this is with The Mission Continues, which is a large veteran serving nonprofit.
Okay.
And they have the only women veterans leadership training program like it in the country. And they have a program called the Women Veterans Leadership Program that you apply for. And over the course of 5 to 6 months, you get all of this leadership training, all of this training and community-based practice. You really get some great education. You get some fantastic networking with the other women veterans in the cohort. But I would suggest checking out the Mission Continues Programs website to learn more about WVLP. There's nothing like it happening. It's a really exciting opportunity.
That sounds really great. And I couldn't agree more, because, you know, when I was trying to look up some resources for women veterans, I'm like, oh man,
it can be tough to find. Mm-hmm. It can be tough to find culturally competent stuff.
Yes.
Things that are really tailored for women veterans. It can be tough to find.
Yes.
But I'm so glad you're looking and talking about this.
Yeah. We've been doing a lot of work on this topic, just because we've noticed how timely it is for those veterans getting out and things like that. And I think that, you know, we've done some webinar series and things like that. So it's been fun and interesting. And I definitely see that there's a need coming from our professionals as well, that you want to learn more. And one of the things that you just mentioned was this cultural competency. And so we're talking about women veterans, but there's also the minority women veterans that I think I have seen, I guess, from my own little digging of research, is that they too face a lot of challenges, and maybe even more just because they are in these minority groups. And so I wonder if you have also seen that and what resources or kind of what avenues people are taking to kind of help support those individuals.
I'm so glad you asked that. That's a really important question. There are a lot of women veterans who have intersectional minority statuses. I mean, women of color are overrepresented in the military women statistics. So it's really important to think about these intersectional issues. And an organization that's doing a really great job of that I would highly recommend is Minority Veterans of America. And it's led by a woman veteran named Lindsay Church. and they're doing some really important advocacy, education, and training work. So you can look there for fantastic resources.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that. I can already tell that you have done a lot of great extensive research, because you're like, when I ask about something, you share a resource for that. But it's exciting to have a resource for that. You know, when we say those specific things, and it's like, it's nice to have a reference to that. So that's really cool. One of the things too, I guess I was wondering about is, we talked about the social support piece, and you mentioned that this was much more significant, or much more needed, I guess, for females in the military, and then for female veterans as they get out. So I wonder, what steps can we take to move forward kind of with this process?
That's a great question. And it's one I think that I think a lot of people have been talking about this in the active duty military, around issues of opening up specialties to women as well as to men. Anytime the active duty component does something to make standards the same, you see an improvement in the status of the military women who are serving. So, you know, while on active duty, we can make a difference in social support numbers by really treating women veterans or military women like they're part of the team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's MOS specific testing that's happening now, which really levels the playing field and lets everyone know that everybody there is a valued and assessed member of the team. And then I think really focusing in the veteran space on the fact that women veterans may struggle to find social support really just means that we can fund and give attention and energy towards social networking organizations. So organizations that are, as their primary mission, they're trying to bring veterans together with other veterans as well as civilian community members. Those social networking organizations are really important as a military woman leaves the service. And that's why the article that I mentioned earlier that says, you know, 75% of my respondents were not a member. That's why that is worrisome, because the VSO landscape is a tremendous resource. It's a tremendous place for women veterans to meet other women veterans and find areas of common work and advocacy. It's just an important thing to emphasize.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that's why I loved learning about the work that you're doing so much, because as you mentioned in the beginning, you're talking about it from a holistic point of view. So you're, it seems like maybe social support isn't like, I guess social support would be in that avenue, right? So you're talking about the mental health piece, spiritual piece, the fitness piece, and then as those that are gathered together, there's a social support as well.
Right. And it's all about building an individual's level of resilience. So social support is the foundation upon which the other health practices are built. If you don't have good social support, you're not likely to adhere to a mental fitness training program. Mm-hmm. You're not likely to do that, you know, healthy thing for yourself. So mm-hmm. social support is really the bedrock, and it's something that we didn't pay attention to for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it's increasingly becoming something we focus on now.
Yeah. And I think that, thankfully that it seems like research is kind of helping shift those steps forward, just to kind of get the wheels working and people are understanding how much of an impact it does have on these individuals' lives and their families' lives.
Absolutely. Research is vitally important for directing programming and education and outreach. We want to be doing things that are evidence-based, that mm-hmm. we know work well. You know, it's always nice to design something based on the good idea theory, but it's better if it's designed based on data and sound practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if, so we are familiar with a research resource called REACH. It's with Auburn University. And I don't know if you are aware of them, but they pull a lot of articles that are mostly pertinent to military. And they kind of break it down in these little short reports. And so they're easily, they can be easily read by the lay reader. And so I wonder if you are familiar with any other resources that are similar to that.
Sure. Well, the research, The REACH newsletter that you just talked about is a tremendous resource. Mm-hmm. And there is something similar that the Center for Women Veterans puts out. Mm-hmm. They put out a weekly research update every week. And so they'll send out those little blurbs, just kind of explanatory information about the study. Okay. And it's something that pertains to military women. And they do send that out. You can get on their distribution list for that through their website. Okay. And it's a fantastic resource.
That is great. I'm really glad to hear that. So one of the things that I remember popping up now is that we talked about some of those resources. I wonder if there's some areas that you think could be continued to be researched, continued to be educated on. And obviously they might be different because the topics are going to be different there. But what you, I guess, have seen from your own experience or your own practice, your professional experience, that could be still developed?
I definitely think one of the biggest positive research feats would be to design a method for testing mental fitness. And what I mean is this: if you're practicing a mental fitness training program, meaning you're doing some sort of nervous system downregulation twice a day, every day, we can actually check for that. We can check in your salivary cortisol, like whether or not you're carrying a lot of stress hormone in your body. We can check it via blood. What we really need is a quick, field-ready assessment to check people's mental fitness so that we can make mental fitness training something that service members do on active duty on a regular basis. And, you know, I think about a lot of different military occupational specialties would benefit from increased focus and increased cognition. It would be wonderful for performance enhancement, and would also be wonderful for bad mental health outcome prevention. Mm.
That's awesome. I think that's a really cool idea. And I think it's definitely possible of happening.
I think we'll see it. I think we'll see it in the future.
Yeah, I think so too. I think one of the things that popped up when you were talking about that is that I wonder if it's, you would think it's more pertinent to have these things tested or trained on while a person is in the military currently serving. If you think it's kind of like a multi-phase kind of system or checking, I don't know. That's kind of my thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, we check, we use the physical fitness test twice a year.
Okay.
And the physical fitness test once a year, combat fitness test once a year for for the Marine Corps. We have these biannual training requirements already. So all it would take would be to train, during entry level training, to educate everyone about mental fitness, about how you get mentally fit. And then, coach and encourage them to incorporate this in their day-to-day life as part of their training program, so that biannually they're getting tested on that. Because if you don't make a performance metric, if there's no bar, that really reduces the incentive to do the practice. Mm-hmm. So I think that part is very important.
Definitely. And it would seem to me that by doing this, they would have this training, these checkpoints, I guess, if you will. That's kind of how I see it. And then they are preparing better for the transition as they prepare for civilian life.
Exactly. They're training to be better in every area of their life.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what it seems like, is that from the things that I've studied, is that they're transitioning out because X, Y, and Z. There's a lieu of reasons. But when they get there, there's resources in place. But how do we, they're wondering, how do I connect with that? And so I just wonder, with professionals, what is the best way today that they could kind of intervene, if you will, or connect with that service member and kind of help them make that transition better?
Oh, that's a great question. The biggest thing that a caregiver or a professional or anybody wanting to help a veteran through their transition can do is listen, to create space for them to process their own service narrative, to create space for them to share and find connection over their stories. I think that's there are organizations like the Armed Services Arts Partnership that are focused entirely on veterans telling their stories and coming back into the community as a result of sharing their story with that community. So I would say just listen, develop a social relationship, and be there as a balanced resource for the veteran. And that's the best thing you can do today.
Oh, I appreciate that. I think those are great things that professionals can take, and they can use those as their, put them in their toolbox and be able to use them each time they connect with somebody. Because I know that they're already making strong headway. But, you know, there's always things that we can learn to make our work better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I wonder if there's any final thoughts or resources, anything that you'd like to share that might be helpful and pertinent to this topic for our listeners today.
Absolutely. If you're interested, one of the best books I've ever read about mental health promotion and about mental fitness is Liz Stanley's Widen the Window. Mm-hmm. It is a fantastic book about mental fitness training, and she is really a leader in this space. Widen the Window is written, it's a nonfiction book. It's written very accessibly. It's enjoyable to read. I would say that would be something to check out.
Okay. That's great. I always love resources like that. And they kind of are thinking outside the box, especially Absolutely. When they're page turners. That's always helpful. Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time and sharing your knowledge with me today.
Have a great day, Jenny.
Yeah, you too. Take care and enjoy that sunshine. From all of us at the Military Families Learning Network, Family Transitions team, we thank you so much, Kate, for taking time to chat with us today. For those listening today, thank you for joining us. I encourage you to refer to the resources mentioned in this podcast on our website under the list entitled Additional Materials. We encourage our listeners to check out additional podcasts, blogs, and free webinars on our website at militaryfamilieslearningnetwork.org/family-transitions.
This production is based upon work supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Office of Military Family Readiness Policy, U.S. Department of Defense, under award number 2019-48770-30366.